Este contenido es financiado con recursos del Fondo Único de TI.
Sean Krause is in town. Thank you very much for being here. This is El Podcast on Channel 13, Canal 13. How you been?
Fantastic. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So you're a professional animator. Is that your profession?
That's true.
All right. Amazing. What are you doing in Bogota? What brings you here?
So a friend of the family introduced me to the wonderful people at Smart Films, and they said, we'd love it if you want to come down. And that was a couple years ago, and various obligations, this is the first time I could come. So we were so excited. I was able to bring my family, but I was especially excited because to see the films that they're going to be making, because it's a bunch of young people putting together with just a camera. And I thought that's very similar to how we would start when we were kids. You know, you take the tools you have and you make your movies. So
yeah, it's amazing because back in those days, even though it's kind of the same thing,
yep,
it was pretty hard to get your hands on a camera, especially, you know, in third world countries or things like that, because cameras used to be bigger, you know, even if they were amateur cameras or...
Yeah.
And nowadays, it's like everyone has one.
Yes.
You know?
Well, not even have the camera, but then how do you edit it? You get the film, or the music, if you want to put music to it. There's so many ways you can make movies easily through a camera and the internet apps. So it's a really crazy time right now.
Have you had the chance then to look at the alternatives and proposals that Smart Films has to offer in this edition?
No, I haven't. You mean like what the different categories are?
Yeah.
Oh, no, not yet, because I think we're looking at the films on Saturday, I believe.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So you're going to be a part of a jury, maybe?
Yes.
Is that how it's going to work?
Yes. So tomorrow night, I give a talk on my background and how we make films through my career at Pixar. And then on Saturday, I guess it is, or Friday, we look at the films together, and we are part of the judging contest, and then we're part of the ceremony on Saturday.
What are you going to be looking for? Is there anything on your mind?
Well, I think usually what stands out is fresh ideas, interesting ideas, good storytelling. You know, acting would play part of it. But it's story's key, I think.
You know, what's good storytelling like in this day and age? In your experience, how has it changed over the past 25 years with the advent of things such as smart films and the possibility that a smartphone camera can give you?
Well, I think it's interesting in that the films that we loved growing up were so scary or so impactful. You show them to people, our kids now, and they say, oh, it's okay. But then you have to realize, you go, well, that was the first time. Now everyone looked at that film, and that's why they've seen it over and over. So I think for me, it's what's wild is the attention span of people. Because great films still are great films, but there's so much selection for what people can do. And so, yeah, just there's so many ways to tell stories now and so many voices and people are more sophisticated as audience members.
Right. But is it still the same? You know, is storytelling the same as it was at the beginning of the 20th century?
Oh, I think so. I think there's probably more of a shorthand now, because even like I've heard people talk about it on situation comedies, saying you would tell a whole story to get to a joke. Joke telling now on TV, in particular, that came to my head, is that they're more like memes. They're quicker jokes because people have seen those setups enough times to go, I don't need to watch 10 minutes of a setup. And it's similar to us. We watch movies from the 40s. They might seem long to us because we grew up in the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know? So I do think it is the way we take in films that has really changed the way people digest and look at film.
Has animation played a big role in how that storytelling has become faster?
I don't know if it was animation. You might say that with The Simpsons, and I'm just my opinion, there was a real shorthand to comedy, and you see how that influenced all these other shows on television after that, and that made its way into film, and it's like the MTV generation, right? It's fast cutting. Well, MTV is nothing compared to how fast things are cut now.
I know.
So it just gets more and more rapid, and so I don't think animation really.
But MTV did have a lot of animation in it, you know, which was very innovative back in those days, because I remember that back in the 80s, one of the big changes in television came from the fact that I remember reading this on a book. Yeah. I think it was I Want My MTV.
Yeah.
That said that back in those days, you know, publicists and advertising agencies would be definitely against the fact that the logo of any brand would change or would vary in terms of color or palette and stuff like that. And they started playing around with that, and that was pretty innovative, wasn't it?
Yeah, of course. It's funny when you're talking about animation, too. I was thinking, it is interesting in that the people who come to our films, the new generation, their inspiration, a lot of it comes from television animation, not necessarily from
movie
films.
Right.
They love them, but so much of it comes from anime and short form,
I know,
or television shows. So
yeah,
that
stuff
is
like
new.
Adventure Time, for example.
Yes,
you know, things like
Gumball.
Gumball. The Rebecca Sugar stuff. What else? And when it comes to anime, I don't know, Attack on Titan and things like that.
Yeah, my son, like, he watches things that I just like. I don't know what you're watching now. So there's so much out there.
Is he a big fan of animation?
He is. He watches it all. You know, he loves the Pixar films. He loves. They grew up watching the Minions, and now he watches a ton of anime on Netflix because they stream these series that are the most episodes ever. So he'll just chew through that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my daughter's a little past that, but she still enjoys the films.
How old is she?
She's 16.
Okay.
My son's 12.
What's she into?
She's an actress, so she's now in a school of the arts in Oakland.
Cool.
And so she does a lot of theater. She also does costume design.
Cool.
So she's amazing. It's great to see what she is on her own comes up with.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah, mine is 17. She just moved to Canada.
Oh, wow.
She's doing performing arts, but she's also doing music production. She's working on bass guitar and stuff like that. But she was such a hothead for Rebecca Sugar and Adventure Time and all these things.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Yes, it's Sailor funny. Moon, yes, another, yeah.
And it's funny that you bring it up, because you would think that new generations are prone to computer-generated stuff all the time.
Yeah.
And yes, it has helped in two-dimensional animation, such as the stuff that we're talking about.
Yep.
But TV does play a key role in how young people approach and consume animation nowadays, right?
Yeah, and that's why I get the question a lot this week of, what's your advice to young students? And I say, it's great to know television, it's great to know video games, but if you want to make films, it's great to know you have to watch movies. Old movies, new movies, international film. It's just going to, the cinema, the language of cinema, is just going to give you that much more experience and new ideas, and know what's been done, and to stand on the shoulders of all those great films.
Right. How did you get into animation?
Well, I loved, as a kid, you know, I grew up in the middle of the United States.
You're from St. Louis, Missouri, right?
Yeah. And that was in the 70s and 80s, and animation was not at its peak at that point.
Right. It was like Saturday morning cartoons and...
Yeah, not much. I mean, you had Don Bluth making movies. You had a couple Disney films.
Okay.
You know, Don Bluth had American Tail, things like that. And it wasn't until really Little Mermaid came out that it really started to take off again, and that's my experience.
What year was this?
That was probably 89, I want to think.
I know. Somebody told me about that, and I was like, I can't believe it. The Little Mermaid is from 89. I would think it was like somewhere between the middle of the 90s or something, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I grew up loving all the old Disney films. I'd see them at the theaters, and then when I was in around 1980, I bought the Illusion of Life book, and that was the whole history of Disney. And it was just everything that was magical to me. And I loved that. I loved the Muppets, and I loved the Warner Brothers shorts. So all that kind of mixed up. And that was really the flavor of Pixar in my mind. all that went into the now 3D. So I got into animation because I love those things, and I took art, art history, and then I found my way into the California Institute of the Arts.
Okay.
And that changed my life.
Okay.
Because then you meet everyone. I met my teachers, were all from like working artists at Disney and everywhere else. And Pete Docter saw my student film, and he said, you should, you know, submit your application to Pixar. And there was still at the time a little bit of a chasm between people who loved 2D, it was all or nothing in some ways, and the people who wanted to embrace 3D animation.
When did that start to take off? When did 3D animation start to take off for real?
Well, I feel like, everyone at Pixar who made those short films started to tip the scale. And I didn't even know about Toy Story when I wanted to work at Pixar. I saw
what year was Toy Story? Was it like 95? Yeah.
So I started in October of 94 there.
Okay.
And like I say, I saw their short films, and then they showed me the commercials they had done. So I think when Pixar started to take what they loved from the Disney process of the principles of animation, squash and stretch, slow in, slow out, arcs, all those things, and now apply that to give an organic quality to 3D animation, and using toys, which was brilliant because they lent themselves to that more rigid feel, right? And so we got away with a lot of trickery on those characters. But the story was so great. The story they came up with was so amazing that it transcended all that. And you could probably say, if that was 2D, it would still be a phenomenal film. But the 3D really, in my mind, set it over the top.
Yeah.
So, I think when that happened, I know for many people, and I say it because I came into it, I feel lucky. So I think everyone recognized the same thing I recognized when I started working there. This is changing everything. So then you had DreamWorks coming into the fold, and then you had other studios, eventually Illumination. So as the technology became more shared and out there, and everyone started to up the game across the industry, probably through the early 2000s, it started to really take hold.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because it did, like, then people say, no more stop motion and no more 2D animation. Well, we love all that. It's just, how do you want to tell your story?
Yeah, but there's so much stuff happening on those fields as well still, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Guillermo del Toro did an amazing job with Pinocchio.
Oh, amazing.
You know, I thought... Yeah. Isn't that stop motion? Isn't that a bit of stop
yes.
motion accompanied by, CGI stuff and, computer,
yeah,
of course?
Yeah, Leica does a lot of that, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was great. I think that Pixar was also very ahead of its time when it comes to short-form stories, don't you think? I mean, the fact that they came up with that little short film that was so touching and so moving in such little time.
Which short film?
All of them. I think that every single thing that they put out in short form before you get to the big, film.
And that was all testing ground, and it was great because you could bite off little ways to make those films because they were, I wasn't there, but I know through learning people who did it, a lot of work and a lot of trial and error, and I felt a bit of that when we were on Toy Story because the tools were very, very different and a lot slower, and so we've gotten much faster since then. But that was sort of the North Star for continuing to make short films. It was a way, hopefully, to do a little R&D, research and development, for new ideas, like how can we do organic characters, how can we do maybe snow, you would try to find elements you wanted to tackle in a short way. At the same time, you're sort of vetting artists. Hey, how did they do as a director? Are they going to be able to work with a team, take notes, go through the pipeline, so it was a way to vet talent as well.
Yeah. How long does it take for a movie of this nature to come out?
A short film or a long feature?
Let's talk about features.
Yeah.
When you do a feature, what's that R&D process like, and how long does it take? Take me through that.
Yeah, well, typically, I think we always like to say it takes about 4 years to make a feature film. Some, like Up, took 7 years to make that whole film, but from start to finish. And that all depends on, like, for Up, for instance, that started as a floating castle with two brothers that were kings, and it floated over the earth, and that completely changed into an old man in a floating house. So when I came on, it had its new starting point of Carl and Russell and the floating house on back in the day. So it really depends how fast an idea can get going, and then it just takes time. And I know when we're building the characters in the computer, we used to take a very long time, almost a year, to build like a main character off and on. Now we want to go, you know, like 9 weeks is a long time for a regular time for a character. Main characters will take longer probably, but that schedule gets more and more compressed to meet with a modern way of making films. And, you know, we need to, you know, trim the fat where we can. Well, we don't need to take that long necessarily. So how can we push ourselves? It's, you know, I've heard it attributed to Orson Welles a lot, but, you know, limitation in art is the mother of creativity. It forces you to make choices, and you can't hem and haw too long. You have to commit to something or find a trick to get around it to make it.
That's amazing. When it comes to creativity and restrictions in terms of animation, do those restrictions come... Are they imposed by the studio as the years go by and they figure out a process of creating things? Or you as an animator, do you have a particular set of restrictions for your own work where you say, okay, I'm going to be working on this, but I'm not going to be moving from left to right on the... You know, how do restrictions work in, you know, in the sector of creative animation?
I don't think we like to restrict ourselves out of the gate.
Okay.
I think it really comes down to, can we responsibly make a movie that's like this complicated? Like I'm trying to think on Inside Out, there was going to be initially some different realms of the mind and lots of characters, and we thought, well, wow, that's a lot of characters to build. So we looked at movies like Sleeping Beauty that Disney made. How did they shoot crowds? And you'd have one or two crowd shots, and then you'd punch in and you'd have a single with a couple of characters in the background, but you felt like it was bigger because you saw those establishing shots. So I think we look at characters as, okay, what do we want to go for? Do we have the technology? Is that going to be possible to go through a movie and let's say 9 months to animate a film and have a crew of 100 people or less get in and animate these characters and not, you know, destroy their hands or have them working all night long in an effective, productive way. So it's not limitations. It's more about being responsible about, like, choices that you're making along the way to do it.
Are there things that the studio says that should not be done? Or are there things that you as an animator already know that should not do, or that you should stay within a certain boundary, I guess?
I don't think so. I don't think it's rules. I think we just go through and we feel like, is that sincere? Is that the kind of story we want to tell? Is that a character we want to put out into the world? You know, it's those kind of questions as we make it, I think. So it's not so much rules as it is sort of our compass, whether it's aesthetics compass, moral compass. You know, we look at, I think, like that, and that will then guide us through a film and choices on characters and character decisions. So, yeah, that's how I look at it.
How long does it take for you guys to figure out whether the character is sincere or not? I mean, how do you know that you're working on something that's really going to pull through and it's going to, you know, pull it off?
It's just always different. I mean, it's sometimes it's, you're biting your nails, you know, like you just go, let's keep moving this way. And hopefully that third act lands. I think it took them a while. They didn't know as my recollection, they didn't know what the exact ending for Inside Out would be. I think on Up, they had a completely different kind of way to resolve that film, and luckily those all paid off in a great way. So you get it through internal screenings, you get it through our internal, what they call brain trust at Pixar. We share with Disney, and they share with us. They'll show us screenings. We'll get notes from each other. In that case, you don't usually take a specific note. You take the spirit of a note you're getting a lot. Like, why are people pointing at that? Why are they not reacting to that? They might say, like I remember for Inside Out, some people would say, oh, it's too sad. But they say, no, they're saying sad, but we feel that that means it's emotional. There's nothing wrong with it being emotional. You want to feel. So let's not shy away, but maybe it's just saying that they're sitting in that state a little too long, or maybe it's not resonating with them in the right way. So you don't try to go to someone specific, this is how you fix it. You kind of feel out for what's right for the story.
Okay, when you work on a character, are you also working on that character's emotions, or is there anybody else working alongside you with on those, you know, psychological, if you would, features of the character?
Well, I think, again, that can depend on the show and depend on the production of, like, we got to get this movie done sometimes. But usually, my experience has been over the years, you'll get into a movie, people will ask, hey, I want to work on that character, I'd like to work on that character. Heck, there's a plane. And sometimes they will take to a character. And sometimes a character will have, like, a real emotional scene, or they'll have a humorous scene. So you might cast a certain animator or actor on the humor part because they like doing it or they've been successful. And someone else may really want to play that emotional, quiet scene, and they love those kind of shots. So you usually give it out that way. I like to also to work on a lot of times the background characters or secondary characters that have moments, because no one has an opinion on those characters. So you can take a nothing character and give it a moment, and everyone says, wow, that's cool, because they're all this. It's more. It's, you've just elevated a little corner of the story that rounded out that world a bit more. So that's always kind of a nice present to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a, talking about emotions, is there a movie, a feature that is, in your experience, the top of emotions in Pixar history? Do you have a favorite?
Well, I think I there's like probably like four, I would say, in that Toy Story was Toy Story, and it was that was my first feature I ever worked on, and the fact that, you know, I would say it was so good, and that audiences agreed. That was phenomenal. That was life-changing and wonderful. And then it came down to, I think, on Finding Nemo, I sort of grew into my own as an animator, and I was very proud of the work I was doing, and I did a lot of work on that movie.
That was beautiful film.
Oh, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, that's one of the greatest things that have ever been done by humankind in terms of movies, man. This is just so powerful.
I feel so lucky to be a part of all these things, because Andrew Stanton directing that, and Joe Rampton, all these guys working on it, you know. And so that was where, as an animator, I felt very fulfilled. Up was special because I love that movie, working with Pete Docter, the director, and Jonas Rivera, the producer, and getting my first leadership role. But I would say that I talk to Jonas about this every now and then, on The Incredibles, because I knew about Brad Bird. He talked to us at CalArts. And to work on a Brad Bird film, and especially a movie as, even now, if that comes on, I can't stop watching The Incredibles. And to have been a part of that and work with Brad Bird and the team, and how we all were so ready to just give our lives to making that movie come together for Brad, for us, for Pixar. And when we saw that premiere, we walked away going, well, what fun. And we were so proud. I think that's a pinnacle for a lot of us.
When it comes to deadlines, what sets the deadline for a feature film? You mentioned a couple questions ago that you have certain spans of time where you can, you know, expand, or sometimes you just got to turn that movie in real quick.
Yeah.
What sets those deadlines?
Well, I mean, it varied a lot, but sometimes in the past we'd have, okay, there's your release date. We're slotting the movie here. You usually knew it would take about 4 years. So unless something changed or you wanted to kind of work with Disney to say, hey, can we push that? Or it's usually the release date you agree upon, because in those release dates you've got theme parks, you've got books, you've got toys you're selling. A lot of, you can't just move that date. Theaters are expecting to have your movie in those theaters, and then you affect other films if you move that. So a lot of times that's what it is. You hopefully can get a good gauge on, it's going to take us this amount of time to make our film. We can commit to that deadline. And for a long time, we would work till the end. You never wanted to stop. It was always, you could do more and more and more. Inside Out was the first film we did where we stopped early. We purposely wrapped that movie in December, but it wasn't released until June. And it felt very strange, because usually you finished your movie and then it came out and you were all excited. This was the first time we finished our movie, we were all excited, and then everyone moved on to The Good Dinosaur. And then 6 months later you go, oh yeah, Inside Out's coming out. And it was a very strange feeling.
Why did it happen that way?
I think because we wanted to try to not go to the end line. I think that, I'm not sure if they moved some dates around, but I remember them saying, we have to try to finish a film when we should finish it, not always take it to the last minute. So that's my recollection. I could be wrong on the reasons, but that was the first film we finished that early.
What did you learn from that experience?
How weird it felt. and then it didn't feel, I mean, as a production, it didn't feel that different. I think another thing that started to happen, and it may have been right around that time, was we didn't have film reels. And usually they would coincide which sequences should be done, because you had to ship them out to be sent to put onto film and made reels with them. Well, now you didn't, because it's all digital. So we self-imposed those deadlines, so we didn't tell ourselves, oh, we can push that, we can do that later. That would be disastrous, because you'd keep pushing everything if you could. So we had to set an internal deadline for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. How much of what happens in movie animation still depend on human talent and craftsmanship or artistry in terms of drawing and, you know, storyboarding and things like that?
Oh, you mean like how much is still like analog versus digital?
Right. Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Well, I say this all the time. I think it's really important for artists to know how to draw. I think it's just the quickest way to get your ideas down, other than writing your story. If you want an animation to start to see your film, it's much easier to draw it, you know, and everyone uses tools like Procreate now, which are phenomenal. But I think it's really great to vet ideas, whether it's acting or playing through design choices, character design choices. So I think there is still some analog done by people who've done it for a while. For instance, sculpting. Jerome Ramft, who is Joe Ramft, one of our great story artists' brother, he still works with us, and he likes to sculpt in clay. But eventually he learned to appreciate what digital could give you. And I do think it is important, because there's a trade-off when you do it with analog. When you paint a painting or draw something on paper with watercolor and you make a mistake, you got to figure out how to fix it sometimes. Where you don't, if with digital, you can just say undo, or do a new copy of it, or have layers. There is something about learning both. And so I don't say one's more important necessarily than the other, but I think it's great to know how to pick up a pencil and feel what that feels like, other than a digital pencil, where you can completely change the properties of that anytime you want, and it can feel like any pencil you pick up. So, you know, it's I think it just depends on the artist and how much of that you get. But I think more and more people are realizing and learning how great it is to be able to say, I drew this, scanned it, put it in the computer, or I just drew it digitally, and then I can switch out the color palette 100 different ways and not have to take all the time and get there faster. So it's all the tools are great to get you there faster, not to be better than necessarily.
Did you do comic books? Did you ever collect or read comic books?
You know, it's funny. I was not a comic book person. I was more, you know, TV, film. I would actually read like the funnies. I would read
on the newspaper.
Like at that time, Blondie was still around, Peanuts, and then eventually when I was in college, Calvin and Hobbes. Those were just, you know, the best.
Amazing. Yeah, they were pretty cool. Yeah, I remember
and
that.
And even the ones that weren't necessarily the funniest, the art was still great, you know?
Yeah, but Watterson was just amazing, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Calvin and Hobbes were just crazy.
Yeah. Crazy. And I share them with my kids, and my kids love them. Yeah. So still, yeah.
Yeah, timeless.
Timeless.
You could say that they're timeless. What was the first character that you drew or animated?
My dad taught me how to draw Popeye when I was a kid. And I would get it wrong. I was in kindergarten. And I would get the idea of perspective wrong. So I would, instead of drawing the underside of his cheek rolling into the cheek, and I would flip the line, and I would have the top cheek overlapping, almost like M.C. Escher. The background cheek would overlap the foreground cheek, a chin. So, but that's the first one I would draw. I would draw the Roadrunner, and I would draw Bugs Bunny.
Okay. Yeah. Did you animate them? Back then?
Those are good, complicated designs. I would do on paper stick people, and they would invariably pick up a bomb and explode, or they would get crushed by something, and that was my go-to fun I would have. You know, I don't know why that cracked me up.
What did your dad do?
My dad is still a locksmith. His father, here's a tie-in. His father, Bill Krause, started Krause Key and Lock in St. Louis, and when we were on Inside Out, they had a doorknob, and I said, "Oh, could you put?" We have a lot of inside jokes. Said, "Oh, could you put like Krause Lock on the doorknob?"
Awesome.
And I forgot about it. And months later, they go, "Hey, we're gonna put it on the window." And so when the mother and Riley are walking up the street talking about pizza, you can see it. And then at the end, when the cat is in the window for the credits, you'll see Krause Key and Lock, and it's the actual logo of his key shop. So, but my dad, he grew up a frustrated artist, I think.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So he would paint and draw as a kid, but, you know, just more of a hobby or fun when he was younger.
Yeah.
But he taught me stuff. Yeah.
That's great.
And my grandmother, his mom, was an artist, too.
Yeah. It's funny. One of the difficult things that many of us just don't manage to cross over the top of drawing is, you know, getting the entire character drawn. You know, those of us who like to draw and think about a career in, I don't know, comic book, just drawing,
or
animation.
Yeah.
We usually just don't finish.
Yeah.
You know? We don't get the entire thing done. We just go through the motions of what we know.
Yep.
And what we don't, we just kind of leave.
Well, it's a pitfall you can fall into. That's one of the things they taught us in art school is, don't just start drawing the nose and then the eyes and then the mouth and you're going to get down and your drawing's going to be off the page. So you have to learn how to do the face, do the feet, it's like draw the whole figure. And that's why gesture drawing, that was a huge thing. When I went to CalArts and did my portfolio, I had a bunch of art. I had life drawing and I had painting, but they said, do you have gesture drawing? And I said, no. So gesture drawing is like very short, like 10-second drawings of action, of someone sitting at a cafe capturing the gesture of a moment. And it's challenging. It's very hard to do. But it comes in, especially in animation and 2D animation in particular, it really is necessary to know how to just have it all down and rough it out.
Yeah. When you were at Pixar and you finished Toy Story, I suppose that the pressure afterwards starts to mount up as you start working on the next project. And my question has to do with audience expectations and how you manage that as a part of the pressure that you must deal with. You know, how did you guys approach that? You know, the fact that you have a successful product that you have a feature film that changes the course of history, and all of a sudden you need to come up with something that must be seemingly better?
Yeah.
Is that the mindset? I mean, how do you deal with that versus the fact that you still want to have fun, that you're working on something that you love, and those are like idealistic things of working on something, but at the same time, you need to up your game after that.
Well, I would walk you through it in a way of how I experienced it, because I can't speak for, you know, John Lasseter and Pete Docter and Andrew Stanton and all those people that were so, you know, they were the directors. They came up with the ideas. But I recall it as, when we finished Toy Story, they had ideas that were, you know, they'd been thinking about, but I don't think they had, like, they didn't know if Toy Story would be a hit. So I remember there being a small gap where people came over, and we still did commercials for other companies at the time, for cookie companies or jean companies, and a lot of people to stay employed there helped with those. And then they decided on making Bugs Life. And then I remember John coming and asking, what should be the film after that? And Pete Docter had a couple ideas, and what wound up being Monsters that he started working on. So after that, Bugs Life, I think the thrill of that was sort of just going with Andrew Stanton had this idea of the Grasshopper, the Ants fable meets Music Man. And that's kind of his elevator pitch for it. But I do remember on Toy Story 2, they wanted to send it directly to video, but there wasn't really a big respect at the time for the movies that were being put on sequels on video. So they moved to put it to feature. And I remember there being pressure and us talking about how many sequels are successful? Godfather 2, Superman 2. You know, there were only a handful that were as good, if not better, than the originals. So when that succeeded, that was a big deal.
Why do you think that happened?
Well,
Was it because of the technology that it just got better? Because you could see the...
It goes to storytelling. The technology is always important, I believe, but you would. It doesn't matter if you have great acting as animators. It doesn't matter if you have the best technology. You got to have those stories. Because if you look at Toy Story, you know, you notice the difference in the way it looks compared to now.
I know.
But you can still watch that movie. It's just as easy because the story is so good. It's timeless.
But if you do look at Toy Story and Toy Story 2, you would notice a big leap in animation.
Sure.
Right? I mean,
you had to have that story that was needed to be told. Like, why are we telling this story?
And it was powerful.
They went to 3. 4 was really, Toy Story 4 was really grilled on that. Like, why are we making 4? You don't need it. And I think, you know, Andrew and Josh, you know, the director Josh Cooley, working with Jonas Rivera's producer, really came through and made sure that stood amongst those other films, quality, story-wise, a reason to make those movies be told.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we're going through our own thing now. We're a whole new wave of directors coming in. The first directors all have moved on and done other things or, you know, taken on new challenges. And we have a whole new wave, a new generation of directors.
What's your take on that new generation of directors? What are they bringing to the table that the older ones maybe did not have?
Well, I wouldn't say a thing that they didn't have. I think right now, I think we went through a wave of people really telling profoundly personal stories. And I think there's some beautiful films in there. And I think we always want to remember, like, these, we want to tell great stories that resonate, that are truthful, and people can connect to. And that's what's going to make people come to see them. I mean, we saw what happened with Elemental. You know, it started off and people were a little worried, but it really got legs and really came through, and it was a success. And just recently on Disney Plus, they announced that it was the number one streaming film of 2023. It was Elemental for Disney.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we want to, you know, it's just finding that voice. And I, what was key, I believe, at the beginning in particular, was we were in it together. Everybody at the studio was there for every film, for each director, we're there to support each other, to make the best film we can. You drop everything to help. Mm-hmm. So I think we haven't forgotten that, but we're really remembering that right now.
Yeah. Do you think there will be a moment where an animation feature deserves an Oscar for best feature film?
I think there's always been. I think Up was a great candidate when Beauty and the Beast was nominated too, but I'll speak to Up because I love that film, and it was nominated for Best Picture.
Oh, it was. I didn't remember that.
Yeah, and so it was, okay. And I think, I don't know if another one was after that from another studio, but, Guillermo del Toro said it, it's animation is cinema. So it shouldn't be in its own category. It's like a musical, or why would an animation film not be thrown in with any other film? It's a film.
Sure.
So
I hope it happens.
Yeah,
me
too.
I think it would be great because it would diversify how we look at award ceremonies for starters, for a change.
Yeah. Even Spider-Verse. I mean, we all love how groundbreaking that film was. Why would that not be nominated,
Yeah.
So for Best Picture.
That was so cool. Especially the last one.
The
Beyond the Spider-Verse was so touching and so profound. What about superhero films and their, incursions in animation? Especially, I want to ask you particularly, Sean, about the case of The Flash and the animation that took place in The Flash. Did you watch that?
I actually haven't seen The Flash.
You haven't seen it?
No.
Okay, well, because that one took a beating too.
It
took a wild beating. But then, when it comes to superhero films, what's your take on superhero films and animation? Martin Scorsese is very much against superhero films, but they still, big phenomenons. They take place all over the world. They're bringing people into the theaters. They're doing all kinds of things that many other storytelling forms of filmmaking aren't. What's your take?
I have my favorites. I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy, especially the first one, I can watch that over and over. So I'm a huge fan of that. I loved the first Ant-Man. I thought that was fantastic. So I think as long as you're finding fun characters to watch and exciting films that make you are interested, hopefully you have something to say. I think you can still say something with entertainment films can have something to say that means something to you, that brings emotion out in you. And I think that can be enough. I think I worry more about maybe if we're looking at how cinema has changed and people going to those films, can you make more, artsy films? Can you make more documentary films in theaters and have them make the money they need to succeed versus maybe relegating films like that to streaming only?
Right.
So you want to see those films on the big film, on the big screen.
Can you?
I hope you can. I mean, it's up to people have to want to see them. Marketing plays into it. It's a storytelling of it. It can get a groundswell, and that's where awards can bring a spotlight to those films. They can gain an audience. I think social media has shown that if the public gets behind something, you can completely turn a film around.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Definitely. Do your kids go to the movies?
We do.
Yeah, you do?
Oh, yeah. We saw a bunch this year, actually. My wife, took my... I had to do something else, but they went to see Air. We saw the Super Mario Brothers, took my son to see that. I'm trying to think what else we saw. We saw four or five at least, so...
Did you like the Super Mario?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was total just a fun film, and that's what... I think that's why people go to see it, entertainment. And that's great. My son wanted to see it. He had a great time. So Jack Black's great. Who doesn't love Jack Black?
Everybody does. I mean, will cinema make it?
Well, I mean, I think we're all trying to figure out what the future is for how people take films. And I mean, it probably is... we have a nostalgia and a love of seeing a movie with an audience. It's a different experience.
It's a romantic take.
Maverick. We saw, it was great, and it was really neat to see that with my kids because that was like a great summer blockbuster that I grew up with. So
I saw that with my mom. She was so taken aback by the sound of
it.
The sound especially.
Yep.
It was so...
Yeah, the new Indiana Jones film, I saw that in the theater, and it is wonderful to see them light up. It was great to take my son to see Indiana Jones, to see him get emotional, and almost, he was crying at one point, and he kind of nudged me like, hey, it got me, and he's 12. So And when the room feels a certain vibe, it takes you with it. It's a whole different thing. So I hope, you know, theater going stays strong. I think it deserves it. But I think, like anything, I love buying vinyl, but I don't want to get rid of my, you know, streaming, but I want to be able to, you know, give the artist the compensation for making those great albums.
Absolutely.
You know? And I'm old-fashioned that way. I buy my music a lot of the times.
What kind of music are you into?
Well, I always love, you know, I grew up with rock. So I love rock, I love classical, I love, you know, world music we listen to a lot. And it's very eclectic because I grew up in a family where we, you know, my brother would listen to country, my sister would listen to kind of rap and dance music. I listened to everything else, soundtracks, you know, so it's anything that just moves you, I love. So, luckily my kids have kind of, through osmosis, taken that on as well.
It's got great pop culture references going on there. And
yeah.
A particular artist that you're a fan of that you want to share?
Oh, well, Foo Fighters, I love.
You're a Foo Fighters fan?
Okay. I know that everyone's love of Taylor Swift, right? So, my wife and daughter, love her. Oh, Maggie Rogers.
Yeah,
we've
amazing.
Seen her like 3 or 4 times.
She's amazing.
Yeah, she is amazing.
And Taylor is doing wonderful stuff. I mean, everything that's happened with her career is something.
Oh, yeah.
That all of us who are parents appreciate and know.
Yes.
From the very beginning of the morning till the very end of the night. I mean, my daughter blasts Taylor Swift all day long.
It's really great to see what a positive impact she makes.
I know.
And it's phenomenal to see, like, you see the videos online of the stadium's full, and then they pan out to the parking lot, and the parking lot's full. So it's tremendous.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible. Well, it's great to have you in Bogota. It's amazing to have the chance to talk to you. I just want to ask you one last question.
Sure.
Regarding, you know, the talk of the town, the talk of media all over the place, artificial intelligence. I think it's all hype.
Yep.
To be honest, I mean, I think that we've been here before talking about other stuff.
Yep.
But what's your take as a professional of animation? How is this going to change things for your career, for your profession, and for everyone who's watching you out there and who plans to pursue it too?
Well, I mean, I speak personally. I don't want to speak for anyone else.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like, I think of it like motion capture or tools like Photoshop. Everyone, it's easy to get paranoid that, oh, it's going to destroy this, or the iPhone's, oh, look at that. You know, it's taking over everything. You have a compass on your iPhone. You've got all this, it's going to ruin all these other industries. Well, it's a tool. I think ultimately, it's the genie's out of the bottle, and the technology is going to be out there. But you have to be ethical about it. You have to, the artists you're pulling from, you have to give them credit, compensation, is my belief. But you know, you need the human touch. You need the humans to come up with the art. So the AI could use it if they want to use it, I assume. So, you know, I just think there may be shortcuts, there may be ways to use it as a tool, but I still think, even as we're making Toy Story, these other films we're doing, it's digital, but it doesn't mean 2D goes away completely. It doesn't mean stop motion goes away completely. It's another way to maybe get places faster. So we'll see what happens. I just hope that it lands in a place where the artists get the ethical treatment that they deserve.
Sean Krause, thank you very much for being in Bogota, for being in Smart Films, and for being in podcast in Channel 13. It's great meeting you, sir.
Thanks. You too.
Take care.
Okay.
Este contenido es financiado con recursos del Fondo Único de Ti.